if I want to build an audience on these platforms, then I need to grow up.
Dan is a serial entrepreneur and content creator. He started the community of entrepreneurs called Founders, the podcast Secret Leaders, and is now on a mission to make brain care an everyday priority for performance and mental health with Heights. Talk about the process and what feels impactful when it's just you.
The process was, here's the things that Dan thinks are interesting. I'm going to just write about them. Oh, one in 10 things is a hit. So now this is the part that gets missed from people. Go find... People don't just build an audience. It's 2024. I had an investor once say to me, and it's fucking unbelievable to me that this stuck, because honestly, like, after the call, Joel and I were like, what a fucking prick. I can't believe this guy said that to us. What an asshole. And now I think about it all the time and I'm like, God, the guy was actually quite good. And the statement was,
how losing your dad impacts who you are as a father.
Hello, I'm Dan. Speaking to you.
That's
not a full
intro, is it?
Okay, so I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, mate. How would I describe myself? Yeah, an entrepreneur, a dad, and avid cat lover. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in that order. Probably back to front, if anything. Cat lover, dad, and entrepreneur. And I am probably most interested in community building. It's the thing that I enjoy the most. But as you probably well know, the thing that's hardest to monetize and the most stressful thing in the whole world, so maybe not the best place to actually have a whole career in, is my overall view, but something that, because I do it as a passion. I always wonder about this stuff as well, but maybe because it's a passion and not my main primary source of income, it also doesn't have like the stress attached to it necessarily, therefore making it more enjoyable. Who knows? But anyway, obsessed with and fascinated by communities, learning how to build an audience, and constantly trying to figure out how to be a good entrepreneur.
You mentioned money with regards to like, that being the right career path. How much money would someone have to give you for it to never cross your mind again?
So I think the magical number is this 10 million people talk about. There's obviously reasons like, why 10? What's that about? So having thought about this a fair amount, 10 million is my exit number for Heights. As in, if I could exit with 10 million pounds, I'd take any deal on the table. So it's fine. Be more than thrilled with that. And well, the ideal number would be 12, because the government would take 2 anyway. So 10 net would be the target in my bank account. Everyone's different. Like, personally, I'd put 5 of that into investing in general, whether that was in startups or like other things or like myself, but like basically half of it would go into investing in other projects in myself or investing into other entrepreneurs or just like investing into things. And the other half I would split out. So there'd be a little bit of money for like practical things, a little bit into a very boring, like, you know, S&P 500 type thing where your dividends just pay for your lifestyle. So I think for that, you probably need just 1 or 2 million quid invested. And then you're basically just living off the dividends from that, which just kind of like is enough. And the rest for charitable donations, giving away, doing whatever. That would be like the broad plan. But it's important, I think, to have a credible, real understanding about what your costs are, what you actually want to design for your lifestyle, and also not having like so much sort of lump sum money that you sort of act like an idiot with it, if that makes sense. So having talked to lots of people with lots of money, on a practical basis, imagining that your lifestyle might cost, and I don't know really, like,
what does your lifestyle cost
now? I think it's probably fair to say lifestyle probably costs about 300k a year at the moment, and that's working out based on like salaries, extra income, and the fact that we've never got any fucking money. 300k a year, I guess, because like most of that goes to the government. But in reality, that's like actually genuinely, you know, with a house, with a mortgage, with nursery fees, which are 30k on their own, like, you know, is ridiculous. And that's 30k post-tax. So, you know, more like 60k. So in reality, it costs about 300k. So I think, because I want another child, I think about 500k a year to live off in London and do it well and nicely. Like, I'm not trying to pretend that's a small amount of money. I'm just saying that my target would be use my investments, et cetera, to live off 500k a year. So if someone gave me 10 million quid, it'd be a no-brainer. Equally, arguably, you could say downstream of that, if someone gave me 500k a year to run community and not worry about it, that could also be another approach.
So if someone gave you 20 million quid tomorrow, let's say, not even 10, but 20, yeah, that you're really not thinking about it anymore.
Yeah.
How does life change in terms of work and where you're putting your energy?
It's a good question. Well, I'd probably want to actually just get out of like being so in the day-to-day. So one thing that our good friend Rob is doing, so Rob O'Donovan, who I started Founders with, that wasn't for you, by the way. No, you know who he is. It's just anyone that's watching. You're like looking at me like, I know who Rob is, Dan. But one thing he's doing that's really good that I respect is like just getting out of everything he's involved in as much as humanly possible, cutting all ties and all comms with anything professional that he has, from Ventures Together to Founders to Charlie to all of that stuff, the drug. Like in reality, like the reason he's doing that is because that's the best way to try and find something new, some ikigai, something that fits. It's very difficult if you've got your attention constantly pulled back into the old world of the things you're doing, I think. So having not done it either, I mean, I've spent 10 years building businesses. I started Founders over 10 years ago. So I've never sort of disassociated myself from the running of any of the things altogether. So the answer to your question is, I'd really like to write a book, and I have lots of different ideas for a book. But in reality, none of those ideas might be the right idea for the book, because they all come to me in like these moments when I'm already really busy and I don't have any headspace. So I'd love to take just like 2-3 months off of being disconnected from actually the responsibility of working on any of the businesses I work in. No podcasts, no membership forms for Founders, just nothing, no dinners, no nothing. Just for 3 months, and just like think and have some space, or not think, and just see what comes out of that, and then have a year or so to write a book. I think that would be a really nice thing to do, and a very luxurious opportunity. And actually, you know, that's what luxury looks like to me. Like, that's not sustainable. I wouldn't want to do that forever at all, but that looks like a luxury opportunity.
To have the freedom just to do exactly what you want.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would love to just like go traveling for a year or go sit on an island for a year or whatever. Like, no, I would still want to be, I know that I wouldn't like that. I'd like to be mentally engaged, but in a creative act. So I would love to have space to properly pursue a true creative pursuit that I've always wanted to do and give it a real great chance of it being my true authentic voice that I'm proud of. And first draft obviously would be shit and all of that stuff, but it's just given the space to know that I've taken the process properly. I'm reading The Artist's Way at the moment, and I'm doing my morning pages, and it's like all very nice, but sort of feels like in a pursuit of nothing, if that makes sense, because I'm not really doing much creative work, really.
Interesting that you don't think you're doing much creative work despite still having this massive content machine.
Yeah, true. But I suppose it's more that I don't feel like, maybe it's because I'm not doing anything that original yet. But I'm hoping that by doing the Artist's Way process, the morning pages process, by having creativity as my word of the year, by pushing myself to be a bit more crazy, it'll come. I'm not really giving myself stress over it. I'm more like I'm committing to the process bit by bit.
I love that your focus is on the inputs as opposed to the outputs. But to touch on the outputs that you've got to already, you've got up to almost 75,000 LinkedIn followers. You've got like 90k Twitter followers, secretly that's...
Two Instagram followers, as I showed you earlier.
Two Instagram followers on this new account, Daniel Murray Serta, for anyone to go and follow Dan. Yeah.
Just started yesterday.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you.
And then Secret Leaders has had 50 million downloads. You will have had to have some very watertight processes to get to here. So which ones do you feel have been the most impactful?
So, fun fact, you know this, you work with me. I'm not good at processes, but I over-index on trying to find the right person and people for certain things. I don't always get it right, but I know my weaknesses. I know my weaknesses, and I also know in like certain businesses what the strengths that are most important are for that business, if that makes sense, or that opportunity. So as a good example, in Kindling Media, which is the company that makes Secret Leaders, Will, who runs it, is good at process. He is good at sort of like the strategy and system of how to get the output needed for great content. And those are the things that he's particularly good at. You know, there's other things he's not as good at, and that can be said for everyone. So with that business, the most important thing that matters is like actually having a slick system that can help you have two shows that are always on every single week with adverts sold out every season, every week, every month, etc., with a team that's delivering to a super tight content schedule with super slick editing and all of that stuff and never missing a day. That's really, really quite hard to do. And that's the stuff that he's really good at. And so that's like the, when I'm doing the interview processes on who we're looking for, I had a really good sense of if this is going to work and this is going to, most importantly, not require much of my time, I need to design this process. I need to design this hiring strategy in a way to make sure that what I want is optimized for. And what I want is not to be dealing with day-to-day stuff. In that business, I don't want to be dealing with performance reviews. I don't want to be dealing with hiring other people. I don't want to be dealing with whether they're doing well or not. I want someone else to do all of that. So therefore, a really good idea of who exactly I need to do that, because it's all the stuff I'm not willing to do. So a good process is, what am I willing to do? What am I not willing to do? Take founders, for example. A lot of the stuff that Will's really good at, I wouldn't say is necessarily your strengths, but like Will couldn't do any of the things that you're really good at. So with founders, the thing that really mattered to me, and maybe Rob and I had different views and stuff, but like we also had different things that we both cared about with founders and both were more interested in. Like, for example, Rob is really big on making sure that the email community is like a really good process for people, and you know, things are slick and they don't feel shit and they feel like they're good investments of time, and he's really respectful of people's time in the, like, I suppose the non-visible stuff is really good, and he's really thoughtful about that. Whereas the thing that I care about the most is like the events, and when people do come together it is exceptional and they're really magical time. Like, otherwise what's the point of spending that time? And I think that you obviously over-index on those skills. No one is good at everything. And no one has the full circle. Like, no one. But if we have to kind of prioritize, like, is this the right person for this role based on that thing? And I think a good example with founders, with you, like, totally picked the right thing. Like, getting those events right, in my opinion, more important than getting the other things right. Doesn't mean that anything went wrong, but if you got the events wrong, I think the community goes wrong. And if you get the events right, I reckon the other stuff can just suffer, not be as good, whatever. But the reverse to me is never, like, wasn't true. So, you know, lucky with you, of course, because you don't really know. It's not like we had actually hosted an event with you before or whatever, but like, it just is a master skill of yours. And not easy, like, hard skill, hard skill, underappreciated skill. But hard. And so it's another good example of, I don't think I ever set up particularly impressive processes, and I don't think you set up particularly impressive processes, but like, those would be two things that I would say not our skill set, but actually I can run a fucking sick event, you can run a fucking sick event, neither of us needs the other person to run a fucking sick event. Amazing if we're both doing it together, but like, in reality, my point is, both super capable at that thing. and making people come away having felt like that was incredible time spent. I mean, the amount of people that say it was the best time ever, haven't been to Burning Man, but, you know, let's hope they never do, so they just maintain the view. But anyway, that's, again, a good example of, that's not a process. That's just really, and the thing that people get wrong, it's really understanding what is the most important thing to get right about this role. That if everything else went to shit, this one thing, that person has to be able to really 10 out of 10. That's something I think I'm really good at.
We'll get back to founders and my performance review later on. But you spoke mostly about Kindly Media. When you have the ability to outsource these roles to someone else, when, like, your Twitter, your LinkedIn strategy has changed recently.
Yeah.
It feels, you can see it on your page, as a lot more like infographics and yeah. worksheets and things like that. I don't know if you outsource that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I don't sit around drawing infographics on Canva, no.
You don't?
No.
Fine. So the parts that you still do yourself.
Yep.
I'm assuming you're writing a lot, talk about the process
yep.
and what feels impactful when it's just you.
My process in general is write stuff for Twitter, everything for Twitter, mostly for Twitter threads, stuff that goes viral, put it into LinkedIn posts. Stuff that goes viral, remix it, do a variation of it. Like Twitter, I've kind of learned, I mean, bear in mind, I did Twitter for 10 years and only in the last year have I been going viral enough to go from like 10K to, it took me like 9 years to go from zero to 10K. And the last year I've gone from 10K to, you know, almost 100K. So I've had multiple threads go viral, multiple tweets go viral. And it comes from, I think, honing in as well. What I used to do is just tweet about things that I was proud of and wanted to share. But actually on Twitter, people are looking to learn. So everywhere people are looking to learn. So this is, I think, the one thing that I've really taken seriously. Like when I'm like, okay, I want to build an audience. I'm kind of tired of like doing random things that are kind of scattered across a whole variety of interests and stuff. It's not working. So if I want to build an audience on these platforms, then I need to grow up and accept the wisdom of what works versus just like thinking I can just do whatever and it'll work. It doesn't happen. So strategically, I was like, these are topics I'm going to talk about. Mental health, brain health, business. Mental health and brain health, gut health and longevity, and then business. And within businesses, like mindset, it's psychology, it's careers, it's leadership. But those are the things. Narrowing down the things that I talk about and then going really deep on the various different topics, that's kind of been the way. So from a process point of view, every Monday, I just spend 2 hours in Typefully, which is the platform that I use just for Twitter. And I just write all my tweets. And I have a ghostwriter that I found 2 years ago. He's been really, really good. And it's worth saying he was actually not good. But he had a really good attitude and a really great growth mindset. Lives in Indonesia, but is like from Australia originally. And I quite liked him. I like, he's a nice person. So we got like working together. And eventually what happened and does happen now, he schedules a whole bunch of like drafts of things. So the actual process I go through now is, these are the areas that I like to talk about, that I like to teach people. Go find content. This is the part that gets missed from people. Go research what content already has gone viral around these topics in these niches. Look on YouTube, look on Reddit, look on Pinterest for infographics, whatever. Go search the internet for these topics. Come back to me with the most viral content you possibly can. And like share what your insights are around these, which actually is a great process because he is therefore going and learning all the things that are relevant and interesting in my niche. Finding stuff that's already gone viral, which means that it already is a topic people are interested in rather than guessing. And then he has a go at rewriting it in my tone of voice, in my way, and I do the final edit on that. The process was, here's the things that Dan thinks are interesting. I'm going to just write about them. Oh, 1 in 10 things is a hit. To now go find things that are already interesting and already have eyeballs and are already viral. What's my take on it? And that is a much better process. It's much more likely that things go viral that way. So I've like reverse engineered the process completely.
And now the part that you're doing is just like the final bits.
Yeah, so on Twitter, it's the final bits. On LinkedIn, like, I'm still writing like 90% of those because I feel much more protective over LinkedIn. But, you know, I've got a newsletter now. And I've been writing all the newsletter. As in, I've obviously got the Heights newsletter. I've got my own newsletter as well now. It's 1,500, 5 weeks. And I haven't promoted it anywhere other than just putting it in the final. I write my LinkedIn posts and my Twitter posts. And the last thing I write is sign up to the newsletter. So I've not done any standalone marketing for it or any standalone anything other than that. So actually, I'm quite happy with 1,500. I also, it's very important to say, no grandiose ambitions for it. It'll grow as it grows. I'm comfortable with that. I want like a really high open rate and a really small number of total subscribers would be a win for me. You basically pay for how many subscribers you have. So it's a massive waste of my time, unless I have like a smart way of monetizing it, which I don't at the moment, is a waste of my time to grow it really big. It's more that I wanted the creative outlet to researching and writing about it. So this idea that I've got, which is the science of success, is something that I'm personally super fascinated by because I love science. And I love the idea of like what success looks like for different people. I think it's an endlessly interesting topic because it's much about motivation and the brain and psychology and attitudes and culture and age ranges and gender and everything. So I think it's really interesting. And I don't really have a space to be writing about it. So I've picked the newsletter. Anyway, the reason I'm saying this is because I've just let my ghostwriter have a go at writing one of the newsletters. And it was pretty good. Like, I haven't done that yet, but I've done that like for an upcoming one in a few weeks and I need to tweak it and stuff. But I was like, that's actually pretty good, like fair play. So I think like eventually, like the thing is with this stuff, like you generally, especially I've been working with them for 2 years now. I also paid $5,000 for him to do a training, like a very expensive, very serious training. Actually, it was a really great investment because it, A, was bold of him to ask me, of course. Bold of me to buy it and say yes, but also then it's just created a much better relationship between us because I think like he really appreciates that I invested in him, right? Like I invested in his personal success and his personal progress in his career, which is something that he really wanted that other people wouldn't give him. So I was like, this is a big risk. If I pay for this and this guy doesn't work for me anymore or doesn't want to do it or whatever, I just wasted $5,000. But actually all that's happened is, you know, he's been working for another year. He got a lot better and he's really grateful. And so the reason I'm saying all of this is it's another example like of like finding the right type of person, the right type of mindset, understanding the things that that person needs to be good at, like primarily. And in his case, it's taking pretty blunt, direct feedback because I'm very time poor for that stuff. So with him, I'm like, I don't have time to give you heartfelt, careful feedback. I just need to tell you this good, this bad, this why. Hulk language. And he's been really good at developing like that. And so over time, things are just getting better and better. So again, it's about finding the right type of person and knowing what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do.
Combining those two worlds, your interest in success and then content, what does success look like for you and your content?
Yeah, I wrote down some goals at the start of the year and I'm not convinced that they're practical anymore, mostly because I don't even remember them. But I wrote them down because at the time I was like, they seem ambitious but reasonable. And I mean, I had one in there around YouTube, so that's how I know that it was impractical because the more I think about it, the more I'm not sure I can do YouTube this year. As in, that was like thinking about I'm going to start a personal YouTube channel. And then sort of backtracking on it, being like, I think something like that really does demand a decent amount of your attention. So many YouTube channels, it's quite a hard format. No one's rushing. So like, no one's desperate for a new channel, right? So it's just about like, why am I stressing myself out? Like, focus on the other things first. So what does success look like? Firstly, growth. Growth without burnout. So like, what I keep coming back to is, I want to be doing this stuff and enjoying it. And if I'm finding it really stressful or demotivating or exhausting or any of these things, I'm definitely doing it wrong. So I'm constantly trying to make sure that my process isn't something that is like draining me, but fulfilling me and I'm enjoying it. I think that starts to come from a place of, people engaging on your content and stuff is a rewarding feeling. But also, you know, being around other people who are like into this and helping you at your stage is also really helpful. Like for years with the podcasting game, podcasts are just not that helpful. Like, you know, I've been friends with Stephen for years, like, you know, not very helpful in podcasting. I mean, actually, most of the guys I could think of, like, everyone's just very competitive. It's a very competitive space, podcasting. So you don't really build up a group of friends that are like willing to help you or are motivated, you know, to doing it in a fun way as a group. That's just not how it works. Whereas actually with like LinkedIn and Twitter, I found like little groups of people who were like all at it every day and all at the same stage, started at the same time, about finding your people. You know, it's like your little tribe of people who are like doing the challenge that you're doing at the moment or that you're trying to learn with the same intensity as you and the same commitment at the same stage. So what's quite nice is I've got a little group of that for LinkedIn, got a little group on that for Twitter. I don't have one for Insta yet, but I'll find one. And the point is, I feel like by osmosis, you learn much faster about these things. And as a result, they become quite nice, quite interesting. And you get to time box as well. You know, you get to make sure it's not doing so much all over the shop and at random times. It's more like dipping in once a day for 5 to 10 minutes with the same group on like a little chat to talk about how like little hacks we're learning or little things that we're observing. It's just like that sense of camaraderie. I think it makes quite a big difference.
So part of what success looks like is having these stronger, small, supportive units.
Yeah.
And that feels like amazingly input focused. But the thing you said at the start was about growth. Then how are you matching, like how are you balancing the growth output focused definitions of success versus the inputs?
For me, I guess the thing that I'm really trying to remember, much like with my exercise and stuff at the moment as well, I'm trying to play the infinity game. So I'm trying to find a process and a practice and an enjoyment that will last versus being in a rush and a competition. And I think that's really difficult because actually what inherently does happen, the downside of being in these little groups, is everyone's doing better than you. And everyone's nailing it better than you and their engagement's better than yours is and all this stuff. So the downside of it is you're like, shit, they're much more successful than I am at this thing. Why am I not good enough at it? And at the same time, it's also quite motivating to know that, you know, they're sharing their lessons of how they did it, and therefore you can, as long as you like try and keep up with them. So in terms of like success metric output, in theory might say like it's X many followers or whatever, but for me it's more like, can I get to the end of the year reflecting back and being happy with the sort of balance of the effort and energy and output that I've got to? That's the thing that I'm trying to work out. Like, here's a good example. Last year, I decided to focus on my Instagram because it got hacked. It got hacked. It was a Bitcoin scam. I was like, fuck. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to try and grow my way out of this. And so I spent one Saturday every 2 weeks recording fresh content. I was putting out almost like a reel a day, pretty much. Really just doing like the gold standard things that you should do on Instagram to grow. And I grew about 0 followers over the course of like a year. That's how screwed my account was. Like, everyone I know was like, this makes no sense. Like, this reel would have got X many views and this, everything was just getting 0. Well, anything, not actually 0, but like, account is dead. And I really tried to like revive it. But I think once you've been flagged by Instagram, if you're unlucky enough to get hacked, you're unlucky enough to get hacked. Like, I've learned a lot about two-factor authentication after that. So hopefully it never happens to me again. But the lesson learned is completely compromised. So what does success look like? Well, the opposite of that. It's a super unrewarding feeling to have invested loads of time, money, effort, energy, and enthusiasm to see no changes over a whole year. It was miserable. So I was like, whatever that is, I don't want to do that again. So it's quite interesting. I have like almost 40,000 followers on Instagram and I'm just going to give up that account completely. So I've got two today. So what does success look like? Actually, I think in a way, like starting again, like confronting the reality of a situation I can't change. I'm not trying to be too deep because I did really try and change it. So, but I wanted evidence for myself that this is something that I can change or not. And the evidence is now clear enough that I can't. So I'll just start again. So when it comes to my personal brand, it's like almost like being willing to just let go of 40,000 hard earned followers over like whatever it is, 7-8 years on Instagram, to just be like, screw it, I'll start again. And I'm pretty confident that I can get back up there and further by having an account that isn't screwed.
That does sound like a very harsh reality.
Yeah.
But sorry, powerful in terms of trusting that you're the golden goose. And you don't have to be focused on the eggs that,
yeah,
that you've laid already, that 40,000 followers. So then zooming out a little bit further from an individual platform, but more about your personal brand, which you mentioned, how do you think about investing in it? You spent $5,000 on your ghostwriter's course.
Yep.
How do you factor in these costs of paying these people into your wider life costs?
Like, yeah, I think with this stuff, like, it really just depends person to person. So if I had what you have, which is time to focus on that, I would do what you're doing. You brought your own cameras, your own mic, you're learning the skills, you're doing the Adobe, like all of the things. And that was me in 2017, right? I did all that stuff as well. So now I'm like, I get paid by Secret Leaders. I take out $4,000 a month. I'm like transparently happy to say it. I take out $4,000 a month, of which I basically invest all back into these other things, or like in theory, right? As in, again, tax. So not really, because it's half. But then I will pay my ghostwriter. You know, he's like $1,000 a month. And when I was doing the video stuff, that was $2,000 a month. And it was $2,000 for like a lot of output, but still it's a lot of money. But actually over that process, I learned quite a lot. So like I brought that cost right down. I think I'm actually going to be like filming myself and just doing most of that stuff myself. I'll need maybe like $1,000 or so for editing a month. In theory, I haven't fully costed it up, but like that's what I'm reckoning. So I'm looking at probably investing about $1,000 in editing, $1,000 in writing, and like I'll probably take care of like the videoing and audio and that kind of stuff for the time being. And I don't believe in like paying for reach or anything like that. So I will just be doing organic until like it kind of works. But like when it comes to like investing in personal brand, yeah, I think it's like it is all about what you're willing to spend to test things as well, or you learn the skills. So money is, you know, ultimately money is the same in every single aspect in the world, which is like, it's just a substitute for time. If you have lots of time, you can do something yourself. Like you can learn any skill and become an expert. That will take longer and will take time. Or you can use your money and find someone who already invested that time to become the expert and give them the money. And now your time has gone right back down and you've taken a step forward. So for me, the way that I use 100% of the Secret Leaders money is back into like people and processes around the personal brand. I do think that potentially like one day that could become a business. Like the people that I know that are doing personal brand really well with running them as a business, like a proper business, which makes sense. It's a brand at the end of the day. But to do that, I think you need a lot more thought and thoughtfulness than I've personally got time for at the moment. So when I say that, I mean, let's say most of those people end up doing courses. The reason that you do courses, A, is because people are looking to learn from at scale. So where you might charge £500 for, you know, a session with someone, whatever it might be, you can arguably turn that into a piece of content and value for people and charge 50 quid. And now 100 people can get it. You're making more. They're getting it for less. You're widening the market anyway. I don't have time for that stuff. Like I'm running Heights. So I don't have time to think about how to scale those things. But if I did want to take my personal brand seriously, that's what I would be doing. Because that then creates a monetization engine as well, which is the most important thing, like making money to spend money, right? So if your personal brand is about teaching or adding value to other people about a certain thing, you still need to find a way to monetize it in some degree, whether that's through advertising or courses or whatever the thing is that people do, because it's an engine. It's not like a charity. So the money has to come from somewhere to put in. It just so happens that I have already got Secret Leaders. Therefore, I already have a revenue in like mechanism. And then I have my choices about where I put out the money as well to make the sort of thing work. Mm. And that's quite unique to me and quite fortunate. But for most other people who are looking to build a personal brand, like, I think actually figuring out monetization within that is quite important.
It makes a lot of sense turning your cost centers into profit centers.
Yeah.
And then this is a conversation Peter and I have been having about what I'm doing, which is around, he's like, how are you going to make money from this? And I quite naively said, or have been saying, I'm going to focus entirely on creating content, creating high quality content that will likely lead to an audience. And then once I have an audience, then I can try and understand their problems and needs and then build services for them, which he pushed back on, I think quite rightly, and said, like, those are two constraints that you're banking on. A, can you build an audience? B, are they the right audience for you to build whatever product and service that actually is going to solve their need?
Yes.
Yeah. You've fucked it if you've spent years building the wrong audience or something you want to now serve. Yeah,
totally.
Okay.
I would agree with him.
You'd agree with him?
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Well, I mean, people don't just build an audience. It's 2024. You don't just build an audience because you have the gear. That's not how it works. Like, the reality is you need to have... The best way to build an audience in general is to have as niche a focus of the person that you're talking to as possible and be creating content for that person because you know that you're really enjoying it. Like, I think a really good example of one of the biggest tech podcasts in the US is called Lenny's Podcast. It's just product management podcasts. It's not good or interesting or anything like that, but it's the gospel for product managers. There's enough product managers that it's an enormous audience. And he's doing great content. My whole team was watching his content the other day because we were talking about the jobs to be done framework. And so everyone in the team was watching his content on his podcast. But point being, super niche, super duper niche and super clear idea of who he's talking to. As a result, can build a really big podcast, can build a really big audience. There are always exceptions to these rules, but in 2024, I think the one thing that I would recommend to you is try and get really clear on who it is specifically that you're trying to talk to. Then realize that there are tens of thousands of those people, and then you get to broaden out. Mm. Like, that's exactly what Ali Abdaal did, right? Like, Ali focused on helping people understand how to nail their exams at university, particularly medical exams. Super niche. And then after a time, it became generally studying for your exams. And then over time, it became being more productive around your exams. And over time, broaden its productivity, which is a big, big, big topic.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. And very much part of my journey at the moment. But we will park that for now, because I would love to talk about the previous part of my journey and how we worked together and interacted over the past couple of years. So you started Founders 10 years ago, incredible community. I'm sure the audience probably have heard about it or have heard of it. And then you guys were running it, all volunteer base. There was a group, there was a committee, COVID happened, everything came to a standstill. And then you were putting a role out for someone to come and run the community, which I then saw, I applied, et cetera, went through that process. And then I ran Founders the past 2 years with you and Rob and Luke on the board. And we had our monthly catch-ups or board meetings. Do you remember what you thought when we first met? That first lunch that we had?
Good question. I just remember thinking that you were really enthusiastic, really cared, and were really excited to get going. And to me, that was like actually just what was really important, because for a lot of good fortune and stuff anyway, Rob was obviously the lead on like making sure that like he took the responsibility on for the sort of day to day. Again, that's the thing that he's much better at, is understanding how important stuff like the day to day is, whereas I really care about events and I care about the bigger things, not the details and the little things. And of course, to do things well, you need to care about both. So at least having one of us responsible and caring about the other was valuable. And I remember having a good sense for you, like a good sense, again, selfishly, that the thing that I wanted to not take any risks on was going to be covered, which was events. Like, I didn't think that we could handle running a bad event. And this was obviously during COVID, so I never knew when we'd be able to run another event anyway. But like for me, yeah, it was just like, I knew that we would. And so when we do, really important.
Agreed. And so then I'd love to get your perspective on what I did well, but actually more helpfully, what I could improve on. Like if we treat this as our sort of exit interview after I left at the end of last year, what comes to mind?
I think where you struggle is where everyone struggles, which is like big picture and minutia. It's very hard. Like that's the founder's job. So like it's really interesting because obviously you weren't the founder, but you're in a foundry role, CEO. But CEOs aren't always great at that. That's the thing. I found that CEOs quite often good at one thing, not the other, and as well. So it's quite a rare entrepreneurial trait. And it takes a lot of bouncing back and forth. And I think that you were really heavily interested in and focused by the vision and trying to get us towards the vision, but consistently struggled with the little things, which weren't little, but were little to you because they were not things that necessarily were going to make an impact on the bigger vision. So the perfect example, just to keep it on theme for what we're talking about anyway, was just events. Like being on the board now myself and like not being responsible for events personally, but just seeing how events run and everything else, I, in retrospect, you know, when you're like, we've booked this place and it's actually quite nice that we've only got 20 people or whatever. I mean, now looking at the balance of how much that stuff cost us in reality and what the difference is between like, it's nice to have 20 people here and it's like, well, it'd be fucking lovely if it didn't cost as much as it cost. Yeah.
We lost 10 grand on that event.
Yeah, but this money comes from other places. So this is kind of the problem is like, I think that you had too much of a utopian reality to what it's like to lose 10 grand than actually like, you know, there were so many times when we were like, AJ, you've got to get like people to these events. Like you've got to work on that. And then it felt like you just never would because you were focusing on the vision and because it's hard to get people to events. And by the way, it's hard to do all of the things. So this is the other part of my feedback, but it's like the reality of it being okay to lose 10 grand on a venue is like bankrupt worthy stuff for the community, right? As in it creates legitimate real problems. And so I think there's maybe two sides. Like one is maybe we were too soft on you for like the actual information. Like where does that come from? Me and Rob. Like, you know, it's not like, oh well, it's like, oh, fuck. And actually just get us out of that would have just been like more emails, more phone calls, get people to the fucking events, which they want to go to. And there's always been a thing with founders, right? Like we've got that problem this year, every year, always did, always will, which is like people don't read their emails. So to get them to an event, which they want to go to, it just takes a bit of nagging. Mm. So the other side of the feedback is literally, so like the sort of one side of it is balancing short-term and long-term. The events is like, short-term, current, yes, it's awesome. Everyone's really engaged in this community vibe, right? Which to you, I think was always secondary for how exciting we can get towards the vision, which is why it got distracted from and not actually worked on. Mm. If you were more interested in this stuff, then they would have all sold out. But then you obviously would have sacrificed like moving towards the vision. So that comes to my second part of the feedback, which is like, no one can do all of the things. So there's a lot to be said on like, did Rob and I set you up to fail? Like, was it too much for you to take on? Like all of the things. But actually, ironically for you, it's like, I don't think you were really explicit enough or clear enough, like in asking for real tangible help. And actually going back to events, so not to the point where I've got like PTSD on it. So like now when the committee is like, or the board is like, no, I'm all right. I don't need help in events. I'm like, I'm helping anyway. As in, because we cannot afford to like undersell a single event, like, or we'll go bust. So I'm like, I'm literally on your team, going to fucking split this list. I'm going to speak to those people and you're going to speak to those people. Whereas last year or the year before, you were like, no, because you felt bad. But no, I've got this. And I think it's like inexperience, enthusiasm and passion. And also, like, I think just wanting to, like, or misunderstanding, you know, it's wanting to be a nice guy and wanting to be able to do it versus having, I guess, the self-awareness to realize that no one can do everything. And that when someone says, do you need help on this stuff? And you were like, really, in my experience anyway, on this particular thing, like events, you are like really ironically, again, it's ironic for you because you're quite good at asking for help on certain things. This stuff, you're like, no, I've got it. You really needed help on it. Mm. Like, we would have been happy to give it. But it's very hard, and you're learning this anyway, I know. But it's very hard to force help on someone, you know, especially someone who says, I'm good at asking for help. And then when we're like, well, do you need help? You're like, no. Mm. You're like, I can't make that person take my help. So this event really better sell out. Yeah. Oh, shit, the event didn't sell out. Oh shit, so AJ did need help. Oh shit, AJ should have asked for help. That was kind of the cycle with the events, especially in the last year. Mm. And the events is such a good example to give because there's tangible, real, like, processes and things that could have been avoided, lessons to be learned, how you would do it next time. But they provide the perfect insight and lesson to why actually when someone says, do you need help? Like, to say, yeah, you know what? I'm actually kind of drowning. There's a lot of things that you're asking me to do. You know, like, we have Callie this time, and, you know, because she's older than you, she's just, like, a machine, which I can't do that. And you're like, oh, okay. That's good. Thank you for telling me. She's like, yeah, no, you've given me too much stuff. I can't do that. All right, cool. Well, Callie, what do you need to reprioritize so that we can do? I know as a community manager, it's slightly different, but, like, she's been given a load of work. You were given a load of work. You said, yes, I can do everything. She's like, no way. And we're like, oh, right, brilliant. Let's go have a chat and see what we can just take off. Or just isn't that important? And that's kind of the difference. It helps that she's South African, so she's super direct. But you know what I mean? You're such a people pleaser.
Yeah.
So to get further in life in general, you have to appreciate that, like, the people pleasing side will be to your detriment because people like you back, right? So it's like you're not a confrontational person. You don't invite confrontation. I don't either. Like, I don't like confrontation. I don't invite confrontation. And Rob is, like, really good, I think, at, like, coachy language and, like, trying to, like, give people space and time to think about stuff. I mean, he wasn't managing me, so, but, you know, this isn't about your relationship with him, but I'm saying my observation of Rob is that's his style. Mm. And I'm a bit more direct. Like, do you need help? What can I do? How can I get this done? How fast can I get this done? Let's just get this out of the way. Let's do it. And I feel like a really good growth opportunity for you around self-awareness would be, oh, because I said I could take everything on, everyone actually believed me, but it was not practical. No one could have. Maybe Elon Musk, but he'd be shit running events. So you get my point.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, like, you, I think, didn't set your boundaries well enough. You talked about, like, I prefer doing this, I don't like doing that. Totally fair. I get that. Literally, the rubbish part for you is, and I say this to people all the time, like, the amount of time that I spent fucking doing forms and admin and all this shit, and every founder, eventually, you get to pass that off, obviously.
Yeah.
But for a time, yeah, you got to do all the crap and it's really irritating. Like, that is irritating and it's not enjoyable and it is bad. Like, I'm not trying to pretend like any of that is fun, that is crap. But it's slightly different because I'm saying after that, I think what you didn't do well enough was just say, I'm drowning. And actually, I can't do that.
Mm.
What do you think when you hear that?
I think that sounds very on point. But it's also, like, I think missing some colour. So, like, I think the, on the event side, selling tickets, I suppose, like, I didn't understand it as being as important as it was. And so I've always been like, actually, this is like a common trait throughout all of the companies that I've run. I've always been quite blasé about making money. I've always been like, oh, like, it'll work out. Like, it's almost like an over-optimism. It's like a naive optimism. And that very much dragged into founders, but wasn't isolated with it. But otherwise, in terms of asking for help, 100%, it's... always been like me pushing things forward, and usually I've worked with people who are interns or just like junior, more junior than me, and then it's the classic short-term thinking, the irony, because I like the long-term, but when I get into a short-term mindset, it's like, oh, I'm just going to get it done, I'm just going to do it myself. And then I suppose the people pleaser side, which is like Dan's super busy, Rob's super busy, they've got these big companies, and like I'm this kind of annoying thing on the side that's like asking them to do this thing for something that's not making them any money. If anything, it's, I'm losing you guys money. And so like there was all of that wrapped up in it. But that was, again, short-term thinking within the like the needs of myself and what founders needed. So that's really helpful.
I used to be more like you. Just work out money, just work out. That's literally bollocks. No, it won't. Most companies die. And then people go into financial ruin. And then it takes them years to get out of that debt. Like, I feel like there's a time and a place for that kind of naivety. And when I felt it, that was my time and a place. And maybe your experience with founders and stuff, maybe that was in my... If I could give you a from experience piece of advice and wisdom... The right time and place to do those kind of things and learn those lessons and make those mistakes is on someone else's dime. And in reality, that was on mine and Rob's dime, and that's absolutely fine. But like, neither Rob nor I or anyone who cares about you would want you to make that mistake for yourself on your own dime in your own setup, because that stuff compounds downwards, not upwards, right? As in, unless you're literally setting out to be, you know, possessionless monk. Which I fucking rate, by the way. It'd be amazing if you could, but it's really hard doing that in London, et cetera, et cetera. Then actually starting the other way is much more valuable. Like at the end of the day, you're literally working in a space around entrepreneurship and founders. That stuff is about creation, and wealth creation is not a negative thing. You have the choice once you create the wealth on how to distribute it. You can give it all to poor people. You can't fucking help a single poor person with no money, because what people need is money. They need food, they need shelter, they need things. So, you know, think about who's made more impact, like fucking some socialist wanker who goes to marches and talks about how capitalism is terrible, or Warren Buffett giving billions of dollars to like cure malaria and all sorts of things. I mean, it's not the guy with the placard. So I think that there's also a time and a place to understand that you've got to sort out your like Maslow hierarchy shit, right? And the more you get your systems in place to help you make sure that you are surviving. The other thing, by the way, is like just being able to get to like clarity of thought. It's really hard, again, having been in your situation, well, not your specific situation, but your mindset, is really hard to make good decisions when you're constantly up against it with no money. So there's lots of things you want to do, but most of them cost money. So in reality, taking, I think, a more capitalism is good, not capitalism is bad attitude towards it, especially now you're employing yourself, is important. I had an investor once say to me, and it's fucking unbelievable to me that this stuck, because honestly, like after the call, Joel and I were like, what a fucking prick. I can't believe this guy said that to us. What an asshole. And now I think about it all the time and I'm like, God, the guy was actually quite good. And the statement was, hope is not a strategy. He said at the time, and I was like, don't win it like a fucking 5-year-old, mate. I'm not like hoping that I get there. And then actually in reality, like there are some times when I catch myself being like, it'll be okay. And then I catch myself, I'm like, wait, thinking like that actually doesn't make it okay. I need to fucking make a call. I need to do a spreadsheet. I need to make the thing okay. Not like be like, oh, it'll be okay. No, it doesn't work. Like, and I am, as you know, like relatively spiritual and hippie-esque. But actually, the law of manifestation is not about hoping. It's about designing and working towards stuff deliberately with intention. And that means also working quite often hard against realities to actually get to the fulfillment of the goal you're trying to get to. So it isn't all like, a lot of it's like, right, I'm gonna fucking go at it.
And I think hope not being a strategy is actually a very poignant and relevant feedback from me.
So true. And it actually annoying. Is an irritatingly good statement, in fairness.
So, okay, this is I'm taking this on a slight tangent, but I think it'd be interesting as further on from this exercise is if you had the opportunity to invest in me as a founder with whatever I go and build next, let's assume I have a career of being an entrepreneur, how much are you investing? You get a stake of my equity and whatever, anything that I build. And this isn't the end question. This is only a bridge question onto the next one, which is more impactful.
But isn't that just such a pointless question? As in, how much are you investing? As such an,
how much are you investing? Let's say you get to, there's a fair valuation based on a conversation we have. How much are you investing? And then I'll ask the follow-on.
Okay, so 50K for angel check, yeah?
Cool. So you're investing 50K into me as a founder, and you get X percent of whatever I go and produce. What would need to be true for that to be 500K? Assuming you had that money to invest.
You took a course on capitalism and burned up your socialism book. No, I'm joking. I don't think you're a socialist at all. I'm just saying. I'd need to know there's a fundamental, true and authentic belief behind a 10-year vision for something that has a legitimate business model with legitimate margins that were a byproduct of you doing the thing that you're interested in. So if you found a space that had good margins inherently, people were happy to pay those ticket prices, and well, as in ticket prices suggest it's events, but we're happy to pay whatever the entry fee of the thing is, and the margin was healthy. Because you're a people pleaser, I think you're more interested in the people side of business, full stop. And I am too, right? So I'm also following some of this advice for myself. When I started Heights, one of the things I did when I was looking at what business to do is like the business had to have margin. Why? I've run a business that was millions of pounds a month, and we had over a million fucking users on our app, and fuck all margin. It was a terrible business. So like, I've made the mistake of having a really big successful business that makes no money, lots of revenue and no profit. So I've literally learned the massive mistake of thinking that what you're doing is brilliant whilst actually not confronting the reality that it's pointless. If there's no margin, you can't make your customers happy. If there's no margin, you can't pay your employees. If there's no margin, when something goes wrong, you basically shut your company down and all that hard work goes away. So I've learned the hard lessons there. I don't think you're ever going to be that type of person. So what I'm saying is you need to follow a space that you'll be passionate about, like happy to work in, happy to build in, work with great people around you. And inherently that business space has the margins and the opportunity to support it. I think that would be the right thing for you.
That helps me think about how I'm planning the future already, actually. So that's incredible.
Honestly, mate, number one, two and three rule, just margin.
Number one, two, as in priorities one, two, and three are all margin.
Yeah, because honestly, everyone who's like, it's purpose, it's this, it's that. It is all those things. And all of those things are more likely to come to fruition if there's some margin to run the business with. All of them. So the first thing to go in companies with bad margin and stuff is the purpose, is your values, is these things. And if they're not, they're usually the things that end up ruining the business. If that makes sense. As in, if you didn't have the margin and you held on to your values, you could ride it all the way back down to zero. Or you might have to save the business, but the thing you have to do is change your values or go against your values. And most people will choose to do that because you'd rather do that than end up with no business. And so both of those realities get mitigated if you start a business that has actually a good business model. Then you don't start to find yourself like completely compromising your own character, your own desires, going to sleep at night, feeling like you're kind of doing a dirty trick on yourself, all of those things. So you got to find a business space that actually can operate well. I had a guest on Secret Leaders and he said something great. The founder of Ella's Kitchen, who made the baby food, who had a £100 million exit. He said, double your costs, half your revenue, and triple your supply chain date. It's obviously for physical product. And if you still have a business in there, go for it. And I thought that's actually spot on. Might be more relevant to a physical product business in general, but halve your margin, double your costs, and triple the supply chain time. Because everyone puts something on paper and they're like, look, I can buy this at that and sell it for that. And you're like, well, yeah, when things are great, you can. Yeah. But when they're not great, business goes out of business. So you need to actually look at it all worst case. And if you can still have even a sliver of margin in all those worst cases, you actually have a really good business opportunity here. It was very literal, and I was like, it's excellent soundbite. Like, I'm going to keep remembering that one.
Given time, I'd love to move on to a separate part of this conversation, which is more about you and who you are as a person, but maybe more specifically and more niche, who you are as a father. And yeah, do you want to start by describing who you think you are as a father?
So I think I'm a great dad and I'm really proud of it. I put effort into being a great dad. I decided when Margot was born, I was just going to be there. I'm proud of it because I prioritized it. And I think in life, you have to choose what you're going to prioritize. And I prioritized being a great dad above being a great entrepreneur or a great anything else. So every week, and I think being at the end of the day, I think what is important is I listen to what other people say. So as in having a view from other dads, what are their regrets? What are things that they wish they'd have done better? What are things that they do well? Like, that's a really good place to start. So as a result of all that, I do almost every bath time, every bedtime, which means that almost every single day I'm spending between 6:15 and 8 o'clock with her every night. On weekends, Melissa and I swap a morning where it's just one of us. Well, one of us gets free time and the other one gets time alone with her. So actually, like, get an interface, like, almost as much as humanly possible. Probably do half the nursery runs in the morning. And, like, she's only 2.5, right? So there aren't things that she wants or demands or asks for or anything like that. But I think just on the bare basic principle of we prioritize as parents, like, doing things with her. And the things that we get right, like, you know, once a weekend, we do our relationship OKRs, as you know. So, excuse me. A lot of that is baked into our process with Margot. So that's making sure Margot gets to see both grandparents, because there's only so much of her life left that she'll have with her grandparents. So it's not having regrets about that. It's saying that almost every weekend, which is why it's hard to organize stuff with friends like yourself, right? Can have a whole weekend. It's like almost every weekend, we're seeing one of her grandparents with her. And every weekend, we're spending half a weekend day apart. And we're also doing one thing together every weekend with her. So there's not many hours left on a weekend that aren't already pre-organized that are just about me, my mum, Melissa's mum, and Margot every weekend, right? So you throw in like the odd social arrangement and stuff. We've maybe got time for one thing that's not on a weekend. But like, we really prioritize like giving her a great family unit set up so that she appreciates those things as she grows up. Might not surprise you to know that, you know, before Margot was around, it's not like we saw our mums every weekend. We should, but you know, we didn't. So it's just making sure that we're prioritizing, again, the right things. We want to, you know, we pre-plan out how many times we want to go away with her over a year, you know, spending a month abroad, as we've been doing since she was born. So now she spent a month in California, a month in Bali, a month in Cape Town. You know, those are things that we're really prioritizing doing with her so she can enjoy being in other places and also be with other, like, other people, right? Like nannies and stuff that are actually completely culturally different to like what she's getting in her nursery. And it's all just like a really nice, I think, opportunity for her to grow up with certain things. And we're also really conscious about like how not to spoil her. So not something we have to worry about right now, obviously, but like, you know, increasingly something that every parent has to think about. So I think I'm a good dad because I think I'm conscious. I don't think it means that I'm doing everything right. I've also got lots of patients. Like, so, you know, she'll have her screaming fits and stuff, and I'll very rarely like shout or anything or just wait. And I think most importantly, like, you know, I really like spending time with her, you know, read to her every day. That's one of my OKRs. It's one of Melissa's OKRs. Again, measure what matters. So if what matters is being a good dad, like I have it in my personal accountability every single day to look at, did I read to her today? And I read to her almost 7 days a week. And I know this week I've only read to her five times. And I've read to her five times because I've been out two nights. So what's the other interesting downstream of that is, because I try and give her a bath and bedtime every night, most things that people invite me to after work, I'm like, nah. Or if they're like at nine, or, you know, I might be like, I'll come at nine after I've done bath and bed with her and stuff and then travel to where it is. I'll come late. But if it's like about get somewhere at seven, for most of those things at the moment, I'm like, no, I don't want to do it because I just want to be with her. So it's just making conscious choices. Without those rules for myself, I wouldn't make those conscious choices. People would be like, do you want to come out? And I'd be like, yeah, sure. And before you know it, I spent half the amount of time with her that I could have spent with her. And she won't remember any of this stuff, but I will. And it's all really lovely. So I'm enjoying it.
I'd love to rewind to something you said at the start of talking about becoming a father and priorities, which is kind of what this all boils down to. As a founder, pre-kids, priorities are, well, myself, number one, in order to perform and build a strong career, and then sort of my relationship and that comes hand in hand. You then throw, you're working in a relationship, you get married, you then throw a child into the mix and your priorities completely reshuffle. How was that transition for you?
Generally fine, because I just accepted it and decided it, and I can be very logical. So logically deciding that I had a new priority in my life and then writing out what that looks like and my OKRs and what a daily routine and what a weekly look, you know, made it all real for me. And then I just followed it. So I didn't actually find that so difficult. I think the thing that is more of a challenge and is a bit surprising, it gets better, but like certainly in the first year, maybe 18 months of parenthood, is you don't see your partner very much. And most of the time you see each other, you're your worst self, because you're splitting up time. So you're doing the shift or she's doing the shift. So the stupid thing to do that people do, but is completely wrong, is you both do the shift. So you do it together. Then you both suffer like the whole time. So most logical people, whether it's someone warned them in advance or they worked it out for themselves early enough, or they've just become so drained, there's no other excuse, will split their time. And so the weird part of the like prioritization is for a, you know, honeymoon period of getting together until you had a baby, you were really prioritizing each other and it was lovely spending time together, all the ups, the downs, everything in between. It's like you enjoy being in each other's company and that's what it's there for. And then you have the baby, you don't see each other very much. And that's rubbish. Because one of you is basically sleeping the other time when the one's awake. So that's a bit of a weird prioritization change. And you not becoming a priority in your partner's life anymore. Not becoming the priority.
So then how does this impact your perception of your relationship?
Well, I'm like pleased to say it's got better. Like now it's all back to normal because she sleeps and everything else. But at the time, you can totally convince yourself that this is the thing. Everyone goes through the same thing. You're like, oh, marriage is so terrible, et cetera, et cetera. I never see my partner. Everyone has the same complaints and problems. And everyone gives you the same advice, which is it just gets better after time. And then you kind of forget. And then that's apparently when people have their second child and they're like, oh, fuck, I forgot. And psychologically, that's almost where we're at now, which is like, you know, we'd like to start trying for a second child, maybe end of the year. And even on that, like we were really conscious about wanting to, but wanting to space them out. And the reason for wanting to space them out was less about the typical reason people say, which is like school years and stuff like that, was actually just, excuse me, remembering how tired we were, want to be present with Margot and not a zombie with her. And you have the new child, as she's growing up or he's growing up, you want to be present with that child too. And when both are tyrants, that's not possible. So you need one to kind of start passing through the tyrant phase where you can give them attention, in my view. And there are ways around this, by the way, like loads of ways around this. But like for us and our setup, the fact we don't have help or a nanny or any of this stuff, it's like, well, we want to make sure that we can give the right amount of attention to our children. I think 90% of the problems in the world come from unloved children, right? Or children who don't feel seen or heard or have problems with their parents or whatever. Like, pretty sure Hitler felt pretty unloved, right? And so just takes it out on society. So it's a good example. Like, I think being a parent is a huge responsibility. And I think that not enough couples talk together about how to practically, consciously think about what that co-parenting situation practically looks like with their setup, with the setup that you both have with your work and how things happen. And I think more people need to. I also hugely commend people who are like, we're not having kids. Like, I just think it's bonkers. It's the other way around. It's so bonkers that people are like, you know, when people say they're not having kids, people are like, why not? It's like, it should be the default not to have kids. That should totally be the default. It's a big decision. And most people do it really badly because they are unable to parent, right? Like all those teenage pregnancies, etc. Like, it's a personal view, but I feel like you have a responsibility to figure out who you are first before trying to bring up a child. And that takes a long time. Like, in so many ways, like I was in my morning pages the other day, and like one of the things I wrote down was like, I'm not sure what I want to do in my life. And I'm 37. Like, I don't even, I'm like, there's like moments where I'm like, I'm not really sure why I'm doing what I want to do. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but like, I'm not sure. 37, still growing up, still trying to figure it out.
So then this self-awareness work that you think people should be doing before they have kids.
Mm.
What's the foundational stuff? What's the must have and what's the nice to have?
I don't have like rules for it. I think it's more just like, if you're going to bring a child into the world, spend time with your partner practically thinking about how you're going to split your time to make sure that the child gets like attention. Basically, all children want is attention. As I'm no child expert, but I can tell you from having a toddler, as long as I give her attention, she's fine. When I'm on my phone, she's not fine, you know? So when I'm around her and I'm present and stuff, she's lovely. She's a nightmare, but she's lovely in her own way. But I think so many people go into just having children on the basis of it's what everyone is doing. Mm. And the really self-aware people are people who are like, I don't want kids. I really like my life. It's very logical, by the way. Having kids ruins your life until it makes it amazing. So, you know, Melissa and I always had that. We're like, for ages, we didn't want kids because we were like, our life's amazing. Why do you want to ruin that? And for like at least a year and a half, it's categorically ruined. Becomes really hard to imagine actually like having fun and doing stuff again. But then it becomes magical, obviously, in its own way that parents talk about, blah, blah, blah. Not going to be one of those guys. But what I'm trying to say is I think that there's a really reverse stigma in society against people who say, especially women, who say, I don't want kids. I've chosen not to have kids. That should be something that we celebrate, not something that we criticize.
Last thing. I would love selfishly to know about how losing your dad impacts who you are as a father.
Well, I mean, I had a really good role model. So my dad was an amazing dad. I think the thing that he was particularly amazing at was being a friend. So, by the way, everyone, this is Archie. Say hi, Archie. Hello, camera.
Made for it.
Really was. So my dad was a friend, was very kind and very values-led and very charitable and very focused on being a decent person and showing me what decent people do and how people show up for their friends. So I think in that sense, like I have a good map for the dad I want to be for Margot, which is not to tell her what to do, because it's not what my dad did either, but just to make sure that how I'm behaving, which was what she'll observe, because it's what I would observe with my dad, is consistent with the person I'd like her to be. Because actually kids learn through osmosis, right? So the reason I care about other people and I try and look out for my friends and I try and do things for them and I'm conscious and I consider them is not because my dad told me to do those things. It's because he did those things. And when my dad had his funeral, you know, I've just never seen so many people anywhere. It was just like swarming with people who just had like these amazing stories about how my dad supported them and everything else. So for me, that's the sign of a life well lived, a life that's like in good service. He was good fun, didn't take himself too seriously, was like, you know, just a laugh, an easy company, and just like, and was just an enjoyable person to be around despite having lots of disabilities, right? Never made that awkward about himself. He just was like a good person, good fun. So I want to exude those behaviors in front of Margot in the hopes that she picks up like that kind of thing. And it makes you want to be a good person, which is a great thing.
What things have you had to like work through? That feels like it's a shining example to follow, and that feels very clear. What something that hasn't felt as clear has been more challenging?
I think just being busy and like, and time, and having like practical near-term stresses that like take you away from your North Star. So it's just like trying to always come back to being the person you want to be, even on your bad days, right? Even on days where you're feeling stressed and you're feeling like things aren't going the way you'd like them to go, and still showing up and being a good person. I think that's like a good reminder, but people will always fluctuate. But yeah, for me, it's, you know, good days, bad days, and try not to berate myself on the bad days quite so much.
Well, you're doing a brilliant job. It feels like every day is a good day from the outside looking in, which it obviously isn't, but
no,
it's yeah, just a testament.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you. This has been amazing. Really appreciate your time and letting me into your home and recording here and everything. So just like from the bottom of my heart, very, very kind. Thank you for giving me one of your half days on your weekend, which is so precious.
My pleasure. You saved me from my mother-in-law anyway, let's be honest.